Well, thank you very much, everyone, for attending this lecture. It's a little bit of an unusual day, as you can imagine. I'm very appreciative of the invitation. When I, of course, accepted the invitation, I had no idea that this would be the day that you'd be welcoming a new president here. So a bit unusual for me and a bit unusual for your new president. I've been a president of my seminary for nearly 18 years, and so I guess I would say that if this is the most unusual thing that ever occurs in your tenure as president, you'll be pretty fortunate. In my experience, you have a lot of more interesting things still to come. But it is an honor to be a part of this day, and I want to thank Terry for the invitation to be here and the introduction that he gave. I actually met Earl Ellis for the first time when I was a seminary student at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and Earl Ellis came to give a lecture on the pastoral epistles, and I remember that lecture. This is the early 80s, probably around 1981. And it was had an impact on me. And so when I was thinking about these lectures, and I wasn't quite sure why I was selected for lectures in New Testament theology, because probably New Testament theology is one of the things I'm not known for doing much with. And Terry suggested maybe I wanted to speak on the pastoral epistles. And that would have made a nice transition from Earl Ellis. But then Terry also said that there's nobody really here who doubts the Pauline authorship of the pastoral epistles, and I don't doubt them either. So I thought, well, that really wouldn't be very exciting to come and tell you everything that you already believe. So I contacted the, I guess you'd say now, ex-interim president, Jeff Bingham, and he said that you interpret theology very broadly in these lectures. And so I said, well, I will take that on as my task. And I hope what I'm going to talk about is a little bit of interest to you, because as I got more into this subject, I came to realize, and yes, to anticipate the answer to the question, I do think that study of Greek language and linguistics can inform our knowledge of New Testament theology, but not inform it in quite the way that you think. The reason is that, for example, I think that ideas don't sort of float around out there somewhere. Ideas actually are embodied and represented by individuals. And I think that's a very important thing to think about. So I'm wanting to take this notion of New Testament theology and make it something that is more embodied, especially in the work of individuals. These ideas do not exist in a vacuum. They don't float around out there somewhere, but they are, in fact, things that are represented by humans. And I'm keeping an eye on the PowerPoints. The PowerPoints are way ahead of where I am right now, just in case you know. So you're getting a preview of what actually we're going to be talking about in a minute. But some of you probably will have studied form criticism, right? How many of you are familiar with the term form criticism? You've heard it in a biblical, nobody's heard of form criticism? Okay. You probably, like me as a student, you had the notion of form criticism introduced to you, and you were told that there were three important German scholars who invented form criticism: Martin Debailius, Rudolf Bultmann, and a guy named Carl Ludwig Schmidt, but nobody talked about Schmidt because his work hadn't been translated into English. And then there was a guy by the name of Vincent Taylor, a British scholar, who translated the German ideas into English. That's a nice little thing to tell a first-year group of students, perhaps, but then if you actually start reading the form critics, you'll realize that none of the form critics represent form criticism in the same way. They have different forms that they identify. They have different names for them, and then the more you investigate it, the more you find out, in fact, that they may not have even been the first form critics. You find out that there's somebody like Hermann Gunkel, German scholar who wrote maybe two decades before these people, and he was influenced by the Grimm brothers. You've probably heard of the Grimm brothers. They're the ones who preserved the tradition of German folk tales, and the folk tale was a form. Gunkel picked up that forms are something that are represented. Or a scholar by the name of Edvard Norden, who wrote something on the sort of form critical speech in the ancient world, wrote a decade before Debailius. My point isn't to talk about form criticism, but to see that until you actually explore what it means for an individual scholar to hold on to some ideas, you don't really understand what those ideas are because these ideas are, in fact, embodied in people. And so what I want to do is to talk a little bit about New Testament theology in the sense that, yes, it's about ideas, among other things, but I want to talk about the people who hold to these ideas, why they hold to them, and what kinds of issues they are raising when they are engaged in New Testament theology. And I want to get away from the idea that New Testament theology is a thing, because it's not a thing. It is many, many different things. Now, it is a thing in the sense that if you're required to buy a New Testament theology, nowadays you'll buy a book. It comes in two covers, probably a pretty big book these days. But that is just one representation, one take on what it means to do a New Testament theology. What I want to do is I want to step back and try to place New Testament theology within the history of ideas, the history of ideas as embodied in various people. And I'm going to use as my lens or my template for this the history of discussion of language in the Enlightenment, post-Enlightenment period. The discussion of language, you might want to think, why talk about language and inevitably talk about linguistics if we're talking about New Testament theology? The reason is that because New Testament studies as a discipline is a text-based discipline. It's a discipline that is based in the text of the New Testament, or at least it should be, right? I don't think anybody's going to disagree with me here on that. And if New Testament theology is in some way connected to New Testament studies, it therefore is a text-based discipline as well. So we have an obligation to try to examine how it is that thinkers through the ages have thought about language. And as they've thought about language, how that relates to then how people think about New Testament theology. And so I am going to divide this up, and this lecture here is in two parts, really, and that's the end of my introduction. So now we're going to the first history. The first history is going to be with language and linguistics. And the history of language and linguistics, I think, can be divided into three or four periods. And you'll understand if you come to the second lecture why I say three or four. I'm going to be concerned with the first two of those periods this morning. And the first one I'm going to be concerned with is the so-called rationalist period. The rationalist period. Now, all of you probably are familiar with the thing called the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was this sort of intellectual movement that took place in the Western world. And it came to be characterized by strong belief in things like rational thought, empiricism, the empirical method, right, the experience of the senses, naturalism, that is, that there are natural rather than supernatural explanations of matters in the world, and a sort of desacralization of things that were considered sacred. So dividing that boundary between the sacred and the secular. If you're interested in sort of a representative thinker of this sort of Enlightenment period that developed, Baruch Spinoza would be one of those people. He was writing in the 17th century, and he wasn't so much an empiricist. He was definitely a rationalist, and he said he believed in God, but it wasn't really a personal God, so he leads to development of something called deism. But he subjected the Bible to an uncompromising rationalist critique. So I'd like to talk a little bit about this rationalist period. So especially rationalism in terms of language study. So within the idea of studying language, one of the first major periods, of course, people have talked about language ever since the ancients, but they didn't do it in quite this sort of modern way that we're talking about. But in the rationalist period, there was an emphasis upon these kind of rationalist precepts in talking about language. And there are a number of major figures who wrote during this time who would be very interesting for us to talk more about. One scholar, for example, thought that you had concrete elements or vocabulary, and these led to abstract concepts or vocabulary. You can see the kind of rational reasoning that goes on in that. People believed in a certain kind of early developmental theory, and we'll come back to that. Things developed from something else. During this time, one scholar made the discovery about the language Sanskrit, found especially in the Indian culture, and he thought that this language, in his description of it, he called it more perfect than Greek, right? And he basically was trying rationally to examine its features and be able to then characterize language in various ways. This is the perfect language. Of course, we were seeking after the origin of language, the perfect language. There were even debates during this time about what was the language of the Garden of Eden. Interestingly enough, the answer was usually the language that you spoke. And so you had, you know, some people who would argue it was German. Those were Germans. And others were arguing different kinds of things. One scholar during this time, for example, thought that you could deduce grammar from ontology. For this scholar, the verb was central. It indicated nothing less than, one scholar calls it, existence itself. So understand the verb, and that is just the heart of reality. So you can see kind of how the rationalists would view language and the world around them. So if we turn then to rationalism and contemporary or reasonably contemporary New Testament, well, before we get to that, let me talk about the key rationalist Greek grammarian. The key rationalist Greek grammarian was a man by the name of Georg Benedict Wiener, W-I-N-E-R. I don't know if any of you have heard of this guy's name. Some of you may have used his grammar in your Greek classes in some way. Wiener is not very well known today. If anything, he may be known for the fact that he was the Greek teacher of a guy by the name of Konstantin Tischendorf. And maybe some of you have heard of Tischendorf, because Tischendorf was the man who found the Sinai Codex of the Bible at Mount Sinai. Okay, so he was taught by Wiener. But Wiener was a consummate rationalist when he looked at language. Now, Wiener lived during especially the 18th century. He published the first edition of his Greek grammar in 1822, and the last edition that he did during his lifetime, and then some editions after his lifetime, where it was in 1855. So over that span of over 30 years, he kept publishing various editions of his Greek grammar. And this marked a new phase in the study of Greek. There had been a few Greek grammars before him, but Wiener was very, very important in the history of the study of Greek. If you look at the subtitle of this book in its translated form, and a guy named W.F. Moulton translated it among others, several others translated it, he refers to it as the sure basis for exegesis. You can see a kind of rationalist principle here. If you get hold of these essential things, you will be able to have this definite foundation for the exegesis that you do. He argued for a unified kind of grammar. He referred to it as a sort of single syntax, so this idea of everything being very rationalistic and holding together. He even mentions the rational method in his book. And one of the ways you see the rationalism come through is his view of how tense forms in Greek function. And he goes with the idea that tense forms represent time values. So what do you do then with cases where the tense forms do not represent these time values? Well, one of the things he says is this. Strictly, and it's quoting him here, strictly and properly speaking, no one of these tenses of Greek can ever stand for another. Okay, and so let's say you have a present tense form being used in a way to refer to future time. He says that is used for the future in appearance only. Think about that for a minute. The appearance is something different from the reality, right? So we've established some kind of an empirical basis for reality. Here, actually, it looks like in the tense forms, something that's part of kind of rationalist belief. So Wiener is sort of the consummate rationalist Greek grammarian. Now, in contemporary Greek studies, We actually have a number of, you think, well, this is rationalism. It took place in sort of this post-Enlightenment era. If we're looking at it, it's probably, we're thinking about the years, let's say 1650 to 1800 in language study, Wiener a little bit later, 1822 to 55. You think that was a long time ago. That rationalism must be something of a past era. We must not think about that anymore because we've moved on in our thinking. That's not actually true. Basically, most of the beginning or elementary Greek grammars follow rationalist principles in the discussion of Greek. And I won't go through a whole list of them. At one time when I was younger and earlier in my career, I thought I would get hold of just about every elementary Greek grammar that I could. The problem with that is that I've had so many of them. I had to stop after a while because I was just buying Greek grammars. But if it was good this time, because I could go back and look at a lot of them to see. And in fact, everywhere from Machen's grammar up to some of those that are being produced in as recently as 2011, the vast majority of them follow this rationalist principle. And one of the ways you see that rationalism is typically in some of these grammars, and you've maybe seen them, there's a chart for the verbs, where the chart has time on one side and something to do with action here, and then it forms a bunch of cells, and those cells are filled by different verb forms. Has anybody seen a chart like that somewhere? Probably you have, yeah. And then the wonderment is, why are not all the cells filled? And that probably bothers a rationalist. After all, we've got this nice grid here. We should have something in every cell. Otherwise, there's something wrong. And so then you have explanations that fill in those cells. And so then instead of the aorist occupying one cell, now the aorist is occupying two or three cells. And you have this effort to make this complete, rationally sound Greek verb paradigm. That is the kind of thing that you find in the rationalist approach. It's found in some intermediate grammars, I believe, as well. For example, I think Dan Wallace's Greek grammar follows the rationalist principles. And yes, he talks about some things about, that show that he's aware of some of the things that have happened in more recent linguistics. But you notice that he also talks, some of the things he just brackets out of discussion, also talks about the notion of undisputed examples. So an undisputed is an example that empirically just presents itself to you that requires no interpretation. That is the basis for some kind of an estimation. There's also in his book a sort of a resurgence of diachrony, time passing through time. We'll talk more about that. And he also mentions this notion of what he calls a cryptic nature of language. Right? And so there's sort of this sense that, we're not really understanding fully. It's got some kind of a thing that we haven't fully penetrated. Another grammar that I think follows that same kind of a rationalist thing, again, they're written more contemporaneously, but they do seem to have some of those characteristics, would be the grammar by Kirstenberger, Merkel, and Plummer. And it has some characteristics when their discussion in terms of sort of rationalist terms where some of the explanation of things are to combine some things together, sort of form rational structures. A tense form may mean this, another one mean that, another one means something where we put it together, all very much laid out, and it's also very logical. So that's the first period in language study, the rationalist period. And whereas the rationalist period, as I said, 1650 to 1800, roughly speaking, we actually still find it present. You may have studied with a rationalist first-year grammar. I think the Mounts grammar, for example, fits within that category, and most of them do. I'll mention in some of the other lectures some of those that don't. But you also find that in the intermediate grammars, that several of them, at least those two that I just mentioned. But the next period in language study moved from the rationalist period to what is sometimes called the comparative historical period. The comparative historical period. And it's during this period that there are a couple of things that take place. The comparative historical period coincides with the rise of another of the great intellectual movements called Romanticism. right? Now, romanticism, we have our, having just passed February 14th, our notions of romanticism, slightly different from that. Romanticism is an intellectual movement, is about more than red hearts. It's basically a movement that was concerned to focus on the self, emphasize more subjectivity, the role of experience. You had somebody like the romantic poet, philosopher Friedrich Schlegel, German, who fits within that romantic period. But he himself, apparently, was the person who formulated the term comparative philology. Comparative philology. The comparative historical period is dominated by the notion of the so-called developmental hypothesis. Now, the developmental hypothesis is very important. Most of us probably work with this hypothesis. You might know it under a different name, and that is the evolutionary hypothesis. It's a dominant paradigm still in our culture that everything develops, and it usually develops from simple to complex. But Herbert Spencer, a philosopher who now is hardly ever read, hardly ever referred to. I'm probably the first person to refer to him in your presence in a long time. He was one of the people who developed this notion of a developmental hypothesis. So things were about development through time and history and compared with each other. And in language study, what does that result in? Well, for example, you would have somebody like a guy named Rask, a Danish linguist. He was writing then basically grammars for Old Norse, Old English. Jacob Grimm, remember I mentioned the Grimm brothers? This is one of the two Grimm brothers. He was responsible not only for fairy tale recording, but he was responsible for formulating rules of how sound changes took place in language. For example, if you've ever noticed that there are some languages that maybe in the classical languages use a p sound, a p sound, right? But in other languages, they use a f sound, pater, father, something like that. Those kinds of sound changes were the changes that Jacob Grimm worked on. And in fact, that was one of the most interesting developments of that period. Those are very valuable rules. A guy named Franz Bopp, B-O-P-P, wrote several works in comparative grammar. So he has several volume work where he compares the grammars of Sanskrit, Greek, Latin, Persian, and of course, his native tongue, German. In an attempt to do what? To reconstruct the grammar of the earliest form of language. This was the time when people discovered these relationships among all these languages and then tried to find then not the origin at the Garden of Eden, but the origin of language families and the development of this notion of the Indo-European languages, especially Proto-Indo-European. Perhaps best known, and some of you will maybe be familiar with some of these scholars, a grammarian by the name of Karl Brueggemann. He wrote a Greek grammar in 1885 and introduced the term Achtionsart to study of Greek. He was part of a group called the New Grammarians. And the New Grammarians, they emphasized that there were certain rules that were always in place for language study. So that's the comparative period. It took place from about 1800 to 1916, let's say, okay? 1800 to 1916. So which comparative grammars in New Testament study do we have? Well, actually, all three of the major reference grammars that are used in New Testament study today are part of the comparative historical period. And that would be the Blas de Bruyne grammar. And Blas was not actually a comparative philologist. He was a classical philologist. In fact, the introduction to his work, I think it's only in the German edition, to his teacher, he says, yeah, I know that you're this comparative person. I've gone a slightly different way. But he's acknowledging that he knows it. And then when de Bruyne took over with the third or fourth edition, de Bruyne was a comparative philologist. And so they made that grammar into really a comparative philological grammar. The other grammar, James Hope Moulton's grammar. Great scholar, James Hope Moulton, studied with many of the great comparative philologists of his day in late 19th century Cambridge. And unfortunately, he was killed by the Germans in the First World War, crossing the Mediterranean. Didn't finish his Greek grammar, but his Prolegomena is a wonderful work of comparative philology. And many of you will be familiar with the third, The Great Grammar by A.T. Robertson, that was finished in 1914, is definitely a work of comparative philology. In fact, he even has a list of the scholars that he uses mostly, and it's full of comparative philologists. So how about then in more contemporary study? There are still the comparative philological work is being done in people like Chris Karagounis' work on uses even the word diachronic in the subtitle to his work, and David Hasselbrook as well. Okay, so if we summarize this, what we see is these two major periods in discussion and the treatment of language. Rationalist period, comparative historical period. These periods are developing and unfolding in language study. And New Testament Greek study is kind of overlapping, although maybe a little bit behind. Wiener was a little bit behind his time. Some of the Bloss and Moulton were at the tail end of that period. Now, in the few minutes that remain, I'm going to talk about that second history, and that is the second history is of New Testament theology. New Testament theology. Now, what I'm not going to do is go through each New Testament theology and count the number of times they refer to grammarians. That wouldn't be very productive, and you wouldn't want to hear about that anyway. But basically, the history of New Testament theology starts with a guy named Johann Philipp Gabler. And that is basically, I use in the PowerPoint thing, post-Enlightenment, but it's really rationalist New Testament theology. Gabler, in a very interesting essay, it was his inaugural professorial lecture at the University of Altdorf in 1787. He gave this lecture where he made several rationalist distinctions between religion, that's what you find actually in the New Testament, and theology, and a distinction between biblical and dogmatic theology. Many people have said he's the one who invented biblical theology, of which New Testament theology is a part. Actually, what Gabler was concerned about was to basically distinguish the two so that New Testament or so biblical theology could be the foundation. And it was the easier task to provide the basis for dogmatic theology. He had a huge influence in that way. And in fact, that rationalist approach is found still in a number of New Testament theologies. And you can find it, for example, in the Catholic work of Karl Hermann Schelkle. Probably most of you are not familiar with that, but more of you will be familiar perhaps with the New Testament theology of Donald Guthrie. Guthrie's theology follows in that rationalist kind of mode of Gabler. In fact, it's almost like his introduction, it's like an expanded form of Gabler's lecture. You also find it in Tom Schreiner's New Testament theology. And you find it, interestingly enough, for those of you who know his career, the work of Jimmy Dunn. James Dunn seems to follow the rationalist view. And in fact, in one book that Dunn wrote, he talked about New Testament theology is clearly part of dogmatic theology. And that's a quotation from his work. Now, the comparative period, the comparative historical period in relationship to New Testament theology really begins with the work of a person that many of you will have heard about, perhaps not read so much these days. Many of his works haven't been translated, and that is Ferdinand Christian Bauer. Bauer was sort of one of the leaders of this thing came to be called the Tubingen School. He was definitely emphasizing this historical dimension of the development of Christianity. He then was followed by a number of people, including William Vreda, who wrote a book on an article on the task and methods of New Testament theology, different from Gabler because he emphasized basically the complete historical approach. Take all the dogmatic theology out of it. All we want now is the historical approach. And there are two ways that that has been seen in New Testament theology. The first is in the history of religion school. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the history of religion school. It's really a school that without walls and without teachers, as Baird kind of refers to it, focused on the University of Göttingen, had a number of key people who were connected with it, Gunkel, Weiss, Schweitzer, Reitzenstein, etc., a number of people like that. But what they were concerned with was this distinction between religion and theology, and they wanted to treat all religions and analyze those religions. And that, seeing it apart from later theological developments. So you'll be familiar with somebody like Bousset's work, where he basically raises the question, how is it that Jesus sort of became God, right? In this history of religion idea, you know, all human religions are about the same, and out of it, certain things develop and emerge. So how did Jesus become deified? And he would say it's because in the Hellenistic world, there was sort of emperor cults and worship cults and different figures that got deified. Christianity sort of did that with Jesus. One of the culminating work in the history of religion would be in Rudolf Bultmann's theology. He's not concerned with the language of Jesus, and you know the message of Jesus, he says, is a presupposition for theology, but is instead concerned to talk about, you know, what we find in the developments within Christianity, like writing in Paul. The other school of thought is the salvation historical. Now, many people will play those off against each other, the history of religion on one side and salvation history on the other. What I'm arguing here is that they are both part of the comparative historical view of theology. One may be more conservative, the salvation historical, but they both share in the mindset of being comparative and historical in nature. And you find this approach, salvation history, going back a number of years in works like by Bernhard Weiss, the father of Johann Weiss, who was actually in the history of religion. You find it in Adolf Schlatter, and you find it in Ethelbert Stauffer. But I want to conclude by quickly looking at whether those two forms, the history of religion and salvation history, have any modern day sort of incarnations among New Testament theologians. And in fact, they do. If you look at the legacy of the history of religion, you'll find a couple of more recent people after Bultmann. Hans Conzelmann, for example, in his outline of the theology of the New Testament, he was a student of Bultmann. He continued Bultmann's sort of approach. Also a scholar named Walter Schmittals. But that stream kind of runs out of steam. The salvation historical one is much more alive. And that was found in actually in a number of well-known New Testament scholars many of you would be familiar with. Not only like people like Werner Kummel, but George Eldon Ladd. Some of you may have used his theology. Leonard Gopelt. Leon Morris's New Testament theology falls within the salvation history. Peter Stuhlmacher's New Testament theology, just published this last year. Howard Marshall's. In fact, Marshall notes in one place in his theology, says that basically he notes that whereas you, to solve a chess problem, you need only to see the pieces on the board, but a doctor to solve a medical problem needs to determine the medical history of the patient. And for those of you who are familiar with the third period of grammatical discussion, the modern linguistic period, will know that that's a conscious reference to the metaphor that Saussure used to talk about language. It's like a chess game. Marshall is saying it's not like a chess game. You need the history. So it's a historical. And then lastly, Craig Blomberg's in 2018 is a part of that salvation history school of thought. So let me conclude. Thank you for your patience, but let me conclude by saying that what does the past then tell us about linguistics and New Testament theology? Basically, what I've tried to do is to create the basis for a paradigm of language about language. Right, so we have the discussion of language as intertwined with the major intellectual movements. And now tried to position New Testament theology in relationship to that. I don't know that that's ever really been done, and maybe after hearing this you'll say probably is a good reason why it's never been done. But I think it's useful because what we see is that whereas these intellectual movements have continued to develop, in many ways what we've done in Greek language study is not develop equivalently. We have retained some of those older models. And not only have we done that in Greek language study, We've done it in New Testament theological study as well, so that even today, many of the New Testament theologies that are being produced still follow that comparative historical model that dates back basically to the 19th century. And so I hope you'll come back to some of the other lectures. The next lecture is going to be discussing the modern linguistic period, starting at 1916 to the present. And then the third is going to talk about basically where we are today and how we could go forward into the future with a perhaps better informed, language-wise, culturally-wise, intellectually-wise, kind of New Testament theology that recognizes the kinds of intellectual models and streams of thought that have been developing in the world around us. Thank you very much for your time and your attention. I look forward to seeing you at subsequent lectures. Thank you very much.